Hello. Imagine this situation. A Christian woman has been married to a Jewish man for 50 years. He dies, and when she dies, she wants to be buried next to him. But there's a problem. According to traditional Jewish law, only members of the Jewish faith can be buried together. They can lie beside one another in life, but not in death. It's an increasingly common scenario as older generations of interfaith couples are coming to the end of their lives. There are big challenges faced by interfaith couples today. Where to get married, how to bring up the children, and where to be laid to rest. They are the concern of all faiths. As British society becomes more multicultural, are these challenges becoming greater if you choose to marry someone of a different faith? Joining me to discuss the pros and cons of interfaith marriage are Asad Zaman, an imam for over 20 years who leads the Friday prayers at several mosques across Manchester. Dr. Jonathan Romain, Reform Rabbi, who's written extensively on interfaith marriage. And Rosalind Birtwistle, co-founder of the Interfaith Marriage Network. She's a Christian married to a Jew. So, Asad, is interfaith marriage a good or a bad thing?
Within the society that we're living in, I think it's an excellent thing, so long as you're not breaking the rules of your faith.
I think that may be the issue, but what attitude do you take, Jonathan?
If you'd asked me 30 or 40 years ago, most rabbis would have said intermarriage is a disaster. Now we say it's an issue. In other words, it can be a challenge for the faith, whilst for the couple it could be blissfully happy or end in tears. In other words, at this stage it can go either way.
Rosalind?
Any marriage could end in tears and can be blissfully happy. I'd say that interfaith marriage, providing the couple know what they're letting themselves in for and talk well beforehand, can be enriching for their faith as well as their personal lives.
Now, Asad, I heard a reservation when you said that you thought that interfaith marriage could be a good thing. I want you just to tell me, what is the Islamic attitude to interfaith marriage? What are the conditions?
OK, interfaith marriage from an Islamic perspective is a Muslim man marrying a Christian or Jewish woman. That is perfectly allowed within Islam because of the very special relationship Islam has with Christianity and with Judaism. That's why Islam, Christianity, Judaism are referred to as the three sister religions or the three Abrahamic faiths. And so because Jews and Christians are in receipt of a revelation from God, there is that special relationship and therefore there's a concession there. Outside of that, a Muslim man marrying a Sikh or a Hindu or someone who is an atheist, then there are serious problems there because they are not people of the book, and therefore that special relationship that exists between Muslims and Jews and Muslims and Christians doesn't exist there, and therefore it would be difficult for a Muslim to marry of those faiths.
Jonathan, what is the reading in the Hebrew scriptures about this?
Well, if you go to the Bible, the people you are not allowed to marry as a Jew are the Perizzites and Girgashites and the Gibeosites, but there aren't very many of those around in the high streets nowadays. So, strictly speaking, it was only in marriage with the seven Canaanite nations. But then the rabbis tended to extend it to anyone who wasn't Jewish. And there was a concern, a genuine concern, partly for the faith of that person, whether it would continue if it was in a mixed faith household, partly a concern for the couple themselves. And you know, marriage is a bit of a minefield at the best of times, and in a mixed faith marriage can be even more explosive. And then there's also the key question of the transition of the tradition. In other words, if you've got a mixed faith couple, what happens to the children? And that's particularly acute for the Jewish community because our small numbers mean that there's a real concern for, do we survive?
But attitudes began to harden as time went on, particularly after the second exile of the Jews.
Yes, and certainly once Jews were a minority elsewhere, they were in exile, they were strangers in somebody else's land, the social divide between Jews and the surrounding population became very severe. And it was, in many circles, just unthinkable to marry out of the faith and seen as a betrayal if you did.
Let me throw a New Testament quotation at you, Rosalind. Christians should not be unequally yoked together.
That is a piece of advice. It's not an absolute rule. And throughout Christian history, the churches have varied in their attitude. And I think a lot of the variation depended on the size and strength of the church vis-a-vis other people, attitudes towards other people, questions about the status of women and what was seen as proper gender relations. There's lots of other variables. So at times, any sexual activity between a Christian and a non-Christian could be punished quite harshly by exile or death. At other times, it was even tacitly encouraged. There were cases of Christian queens being married off it wasn't their choice to be married to pagan kings. But the story of Queen Ethelburg being married to King Edwin of Northumbria is an example of a dynastic marriage, which in the end was seen by the Christian church as a good thing because it brought Christianity to Northumbria.
It should be said that the quotation comes from St. Paul. He said you should not be unequally yoked together. It's an interesting distinction between advice and admonition. But I want to come back to you, Asad. Why is there a gender inequality? Why is it all right for a Muslim man to marry a non-Muslim woman, but it's not all right for a Muslim woman to marry a non-Muslim man?
It's a very good question, and one that I've asked. And, you know, in the context that we are living in, clearly there seems to be an inequality. But the attitude that Islam takes is man in a Muslim marriage, he is the dominant figure, the breadwinner, etc., and therefore he is more likely to allow concessions towards a wife who is a Christian, to allow her to go to church, to allow her to basically live her life as a Christian, or a Jewish woman who wants to go to synagogue and live her life as a Jew. He's more likely to allow that because of his status within a marriage than the other way around.
I must say that sounds a bit paternalistic to me, because that may have applied in Middle Ages, but doesn't really apply today. And I say that in humility, because, you know, Judaism has also had to adapt to the new social reality. And certainly the concern about mixed-faith marriages applies, from our perspective, whichever gender the person it is that marries out, not because of the male-female relationship, but just because what's happening to the faith in the family and what's happening to the next generation.
Rosalind?
And I would say that the mother in a family is very influential in the spiritual upbringing of children, particularly if she's the one that stays at home and brings them up. But I'm interested in your viewpoint, because it is one that is fairly commonplace. It certainly was in the ancient world, the standard viewpoint. But I think now, as women have access to education and careers, I think the situation is probably very different than it was when the Quran was written and when the early founders of Islam.
And Asad, it has to be said that the Quran is a bit ambivalent. The reading that distinguishes between men and women is not at all clear.
The roles of men and women are very clearly different, and Islam makes no bones about that. That is why psychologically, emotionally, physically, we are different creatures. And so the famous name of the book, Men are from Mars and Women are from Venus. You know, we are different people with different roles. We are not equal, but we are equally important in terms of our roles. And therefore, to recognise what those roles are and to live those roles basically creates a much more harmonious family atmosphere, and therefore a harmonious society.
It's sort of countercultural, though, isn't it, in today's world?
Well, look, I totally agree with you that, you know, there are Muslim women who are marrying and choose to marry non-Muslim husbands, and it is happening. And all I can say is there is an Islamic perspective and there is what people do. And people can follow whatever, laws and rules they want to, but I can only give you, from a theological point of view, what is acceptable or not.
Are there any parallels with Judaism, Jonathan? Are there any rules and regulations? Because the Orthodox would take a very different approach to what you take.
Yes, I mean, certainly Orthodox Judaism would not countenance an intermarriage, and they would see it, some would just see it as wrong, others would see it as much stronger, a sin, a cancer, a kiss of death and youth, quite, you know, strong language, because they are genuinely worried about the future. As a Reform rabbi, we also think that it's actually probably best if you marry within the faith, because then you're heading in the same direction. But we recognise social reality, and I can't legislate for whom other people fall in love with. And therefore, we would certainly see, if someone comes as a mixed-faith couple, we would treat them well. And nowadays, we've had to adapt and say, well, actually, the Jewish person is still Jewish. The non-Jewish person is a human being and should be welcomed. And we will even do mixed-faith blessings, because we need to accommodate the new social reality.
So, Jonathan, what you're basically saying is, within Orthodox Judaism, the accommodation Islam has towards Jews do not have towards Muslims.
correct, except that it's not just Muslims. They would take the same attitude to a Christian, a secularist, a Hindu, anybody who wasn't of that same faith.
And I can see a problem arising there, because there was an article just recently that within 20, 30 years' time, the majority of Jews in this country will be Orthodox.
That's one projection, but to be honest with you, as a congregational rabbi, I have to deal with the here and now, and I think it's around about 50% of current Jews are marrying somebody not Jewish, and we can either slam the phone down or we can actually be responsive, because actually a lot of people are not necessarily rejecting their Judaism, they still want to carry it on.
Well, let me remind you that you're listening to Beyond Belief, and today we're discussing interfaith marriage. In an increasingly multicultural society, it's inevitable that more and more of us will meet and fall in love with people who belong to a different faith tradition. What problems are they likely to face? And with me are Rosalind Birtwistle, Jonathan Romain and Asad Zaman. When Ruby, which is not her real name, a young devout Sikh, was preparing her wedding to her Hindu fiancé, she went to the authorities at her local Sikh temple. There was to be a civil ceremony first, then a blessing in the Gurdwara. All was in place, 300 guests invited, the food prepared.
It was meant to be the day that I was spiritually blessed by the Guru Granth Sahib Ji on the day. And what happened was I was getting ready to go to my wedding day and getting my beautiful clothes on and getting ready. And we got a phone call at 6:45 in the morning by the priest of the Gurdwara saying the wedding is going to be cancelled because we've got about 40 Sikh militants outside the Gurdwara, and they've bombarded the Gurdwara. Basically, they've shut the Gurdwara down. And do not get married here, because they've told us that if there is going to be a wedding here, and if you guys do decide to get married here, there's going to be more than bloodshed there.
What did they say their objections were?
The objections were was that I was not getting married to a Sikh man.
So as the prospective husband, how did that appear to you?
Well, I was quite shocked when I got a phone call from my wife's brother-in-law to say that the wedding had been cancelled. I was on my way up. My immediate concern was, one, for everyone's welfare, and two, for my wife, you know, what she must be thinking as well. So, and it was, you know, it was obviously quite a testing time, because we didn't know what we were going to do.
Because presumably the authorities at the Gurdwara had already agreed to this wedding.
Absolutely, they did. We even checked in with them. We said, look, is there going to be any concerns about the fact that I'm a Sikh and my husband's non-Sikh? And, you know, and the gentleman who booked our wedding was quite happy to take our fee. It wasn't about the money. It was about the fact that I wanted to be blessed under the Guru Granth Sahib Ji, as are many, many Sikh boys and girls are getting married. They're still doing it, getting married to people that they want to be married to who are non-Sikh, and it's still happening in many Gurdwaras. We were told, yes, everything's going to go ahead.
So do you think that the authorities gave way? Did they yield to the pressure from outsiders?
I think they did. And the priest, apparently, on the day had to lock himself in a room upstairs at the top of the Gurdwara, because they were ready to kill him too.
They really didn't have a choice, these guys, these militants. They actually stormed the Gurdwara and they threatened the staff at the Gurdwara, and they were wielding knives and swords and everything like that as well. And actually the police were called to the Gurdwara on the morning, and they did mention as well to my brother-in-law that we had a right to have our wedding in the Gurdwara, and they would actually create a cordon for us. But I think the risk was just way too high, because these guys, they knew where my wife's parents lived. There were a couple of the militants had turned up to her house. And they'd also called around other Gurdwaras as well to say, don't perform the wedding ceremony for these two individuals, otherwise they're going to go there as well. So the issue is that, you know, there might have been 40 militants there in the morning, but if we had continued with it, I'm pretty sure that there would have been 400 by 10 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, I'm pretty sure a riot would have ensued as well. And I guess, you know, from my point of view, you know, I couldn't guarantee my family's safety or my wife's safety or anyone's safety. And so we had to think of alternative plans.
Some of our family and friends had already turned up to the temple, and they were told, get out of here, there's not going to be a wedding. Very rude, very thuggish approach. Get out of here, don't come to this temple, there's no such thing as a wedding here, don't even think about coming back. And you know, the temple is a place of spiritual worship, and it's a place where people find peace and comfort.
What impact has it had on your relationship to your Sikhism?
I've never gone back into a temple again. And I used to go to temple every week. I will never go back into a Sikh Gurdwara unless it was obviously for a friend's wedding or funeral. I don't feel part of that community. I'm absolutely gobsmacked at the way that the Sikh community have reacted towards interfaith marriage over the last couple of years. It happens in some Gurdwaras, it doesn't happen in others. And there should be a straight rule. Either you're going to do it or you're not. And actually, to be honest, they shouldn't be doing this.
Fortunately, our couple were able to find a local community hall in which to hold their wedding celebration. The Sikh Council UK has responded by issuing a code of conduct designed to address uncertainties and stop these kinds of incidents. Marrying people of other faiths is acceptable, they said, but marrying them in a Sikh temple is not. So, Asad, what do you feel about that interview?
Very saddened, really, that things could go to such an extreme that people with knives and swords could be ready to kill because of a union that they didn't agree with. Certainly from an Islamic perspective, if that union is legitimate, it can take place absolutely anywhere. But, you know, this is, I think this is going to happen more and more because you've got within the Sikh, within Muslims, within, you've already had it within the Jews and the Christians. You've got your Orthodox and you've got your liberal. And the liberal will not be too particular about each and every law of their faith. And the Orthodox will want to maintain the orthodoxy of their faith. And there's going to be that increasing clash.
Rosalind.
It's terribly, terribly sad. I can't say I'm really surprised because there have been flurries of this sort of thing going on. But what I feel is sad is that the local Gurdwara had approved the marriage. They'd obviously satisfied themselves that the couple were sincere. And for other people to come in, probably recruited through social media or whatever, for other people to come in and disrupt it, I really think it's terribly sad.
Jonathan, there's a certain logic behind the opposition. If you hold very firmly to a faith tradition and you believe that that is the right tradition, there is a sort of logic which says that you can't dilute that in any way, and that to have that sort of marriage ceremony within a temple or a synagogue or a church is in a sense to water it down.
Not necessarily. I mean, there's a logic in saying, look, we have certain values and traditions and we want to continue. But look, this was not just awful on a personal level, but it was actually a massive religious own goal, because the non-Sikh partner was willing to have a ceremony in the Gurdwara to honour his bride and his bride's family. It meant he was taking it seriously, he was respecting it, and he was a wonderful opportunity for them to make sure that the Sikh tradition did continue. Because, you know, I've counselled maybe like something like 3,000 couples over the years in mixed faith marriages. Never did they say, Rabbi, shall we get married? They always said, Rabbi, we are getting married. Can you help? In other words, we can't affect the intermarriage patterns that are going on. It's a sociological reality. What we can do is ensure whether they walk a million miles in the opposite direction or whether they will, with our help, continue those traditions in the next generation.
Asad, what do you think of the principle of maintaining the purity, in a sense, by not allowing this sort of watering down?
You are going to get the Orthodox who will want to maintain the purity of their faith, and then you will get probably the majority who have been brought up here, who haven't been sort of brought up within the sort of rules of their faith, if you like, who have had a fairly liberal upbringing, and they won't be too keen on necessarily sticking to every aspect of their faith, and therefore you are going to get this schism within Judaism.
Actually,
you know, you've got your Orthodox and your non-Orthodox.
I'm not sure if you're right about it being the non-Orthodox, because intermarriage is not because you are less religious or you're less knowledgeable. Intermarriage is because you happen to mix in wider society, whether it's at the office or at university or a gym, and you meet somebody. And a lot of the people we see marrying non-Jews have had a good Jewish homes, good Jewish education, but they just so happen to fall in love with somebody else.
I know, Jonathan, but where I would perhaps disagree a little there is that as a Muslim man, I would make sure that I do not fall in love with, for example, an atheist.
No, you wouldn't. Or I'll tell you why.
I wouldn't, because I know that relationship would be simply not valid.
Okay, maybe that's true for you personally. I accept that. But so many of the couples I see say, I always intended to marry a fellow Jew, but... And they genuinely did, but you just can't affect the chance.
Rosalind.
I also find that meeting somebody of another faith can be part of the attraction if you're devoted to your own faith, because here is somebody that's equally devoted to something else. And it becomes intriguing. You talk about it. sometimes you end up falling in love with this person.
Do you think it's ever reasonable to make conversion to a faith tradition a condition of the wedding?
Well, again, it depends on what the faith is. Some faiths are going to not have a problem with that, and others are. You know, I don't make the rules. The rules are there pretty much hardwired into the Quran regarding, for example, alcohol. I cannot legislate to say, well, alcohol now, because we've got alcohol all around us, it should now be legitimate. It's how we socialise, etc. And therefore, it should be allowed. I can't legislate. This is God's rule. Only God can change that.
But just to be absolutely clear, that if a woman came to you and said she wanted to marry a non-Muslim, conversion would basically be the only possibility.
Yes, to legitimately sort of have that, what we call nikah, or the Islamic marriage ceremony, to be recognised under Islamic law. That would be the only path, yes.
Could I ask, would you, if a married Muslim woman who had married a non-Muslim came to you for help with some other matter, for some other spiritual matter, would you treat her as you would any other member of your community?
Without a shadow of doubt. Look, if a Muslim woman marries out of the faith, that is a matter between her and her maker. Mm. But as a person, anyone who comes to me, I will always give them the best advice that I can.
If she wanted help with bringing up her children as Muslims, you'd be able to assist with that. You wouldn't?
Oh, absolutely. Without a shadow of doubt, I would have no hesitation at all.
What difficulties, Rosalind, are people who are engaged in an interfaith marriage likely to face?
Quite often, they are happily going along. It's when there's a crisis, there's a family crisis. I do remember one quite sad case of a child dying. It was an unexpected death. Dad was Muslim, mum was a nominal Christian. The child had been brought up as a Muslim. The burial took place quite quickly, and it was a men-only affair. Now, this lady, the mother of the child, had come from a tradition where she would normally expect to be burying her child, to be at the funeral. So it was a sort of cultural thing, and there was no one around to support her, because in the community that she'd married into, the women would sit and mourn with her, but she didn't find that a comfort. So whether it was religious, whether it was cultural, I don't know, but it does sometimes happen.
Actually, and it's not just the times of crisis. I find it sometimes those everyday things that cause people to trip over. I'm thinking of one particular couple. They had a lovely courtship engagement, and then things went pear-shaped the first day back when she thought she'd do a rather nice thing, bring her husband breakfast in bed and took up bacon and eggs. And he, being Jewish, went berserk. They just hadn't talked about something as basic as food.
It's pretty important that you do talk about these issues.
Well, absolutely right. I mean, another couple, you know, had a great time, everything was fine, and then come Christmas, she brought home a Christmas tree, being a nominal Christian, thought it would be a nice decoration for the front living room. He, being Jewish, thought it was a declaration of religious war. So you're quite right. What's absolutely key is for the couples to talk to each other, and that's the golden rule I always tell them. Discuss everything in advance, not just bank accounts or sort of where you're going to have holidays, but how you're going to bring up the children, what you're going to do with the in-laws, the festivals, the family, the foods, what goes in your fridge.
Sometimes families want it all sorted. So they'll say, right, how are you bringing up your children? Will they be baptised? Will this, that or the other happen? We tell couples they may well feel different if and when they have children, not to make agreements that they might find difficult to keep, but to learn to talk with one another.
One issue, Jonathan, particularly relevant to Judaism, is the issue of what happens when one of the partners dies. The Jewish partner dies, the non-Jewish is left living. What will happen to the burial? Will the two be able to lie together for eternity?
Until recently, the answer was no, and we did not do mixed faith burials. But again, the Reform and liberal rabbis have recognised that if a couple have been together for 40 or 50 years in life, who are we to separate them in death? So we do mixed faith burials together in the same cemetery, in the same plot. Perhaps another question is, who does the service? Is it best if it's the minister of the person who died who can give the correct last rites, or the minister of the person who survived who can do all the pastoral care? And actually, I've very often done a funeral for maybe, say, 40 people, and there's only been two Jews present. And one was myself, and the other was a corpse. Because here am I ministering to someone who'd married into a non-Jewish family, and I was trying to make a user-friendly service for everyone concerned.
Asad?
Yeah, in those situations, you know, there has to be some degree of compromise, especially when it comes to funerals. If Christians want to do a Christian burial, Muslims want to do the Muslim burial, well, why not have both? You know, I mean, it's just a ceremony at the end of the day.
Except it does beg the question, if you and I are being so, and I think correctly, helpful regarding to funerals, why shouldn't we extend that same help to the weddings? We're happy to sort of help when they exit life. What about when they start life? And I think that's what's framed our thinking, is that maybe we've got it right at the end of life, we haven't got it right quite at the beginning of the marriage.
Rosalind?
A mixed faith funeral can be a wonderful opportunity for families to come together, because it can be quite touching for perhaps two sets of family who haven't had a lot to do with each other. Sometimes a widow is touched by, you know, the father-in-law helping at that point.
I think the problem would be if the Christian wanted to cremate the body. That would be a problem, because it is forbidden to cremate in Islam. There would be a real problem. Otherwise, I don't think there are many serious issues.
Many Christian ministers who'd insist on cremation. They would do it if it was the only practical solution, but I don't think they'd absolutely insist on it.
And curiously enough, a lot of mixed-faith couples until recently have actually preferred cremation precisely because it avoids a territorial problem. You know, whose cemetery do we get buried in, his and hers? And do the children want to visit mum and dad in separate places? And therefore they have the funeral in the same crematorium and get their ashes scattered under the same non-denominational rosebush.
Personally, I don't think the cremation element would be far more serious than exactly where they're buried.
I'd like to ask each one of you a final question, bring this fascinating discussion to a close. As our society in the UK inevitably becomes more multicultural, do you think is interfaith marriage going to become any easier? Rosalind?
I think as mixed marriages become more mainstream, there is more experience to draw on. Groups like ours help people because they can come along and meet other people perhaps 10, 20, 30 years along the way. So I think for couples it is going to become easier. I hope it is.
Asad?
For practising Muslims, they will always want to stay within the faith and stick to the rules. Whereas those who are non-practising, their attitude is going to be more liberal and they won't care too much about whether Islam endorses that wedding or not.
Jonathan?
I think the sheer weight of numbers as society becomes much more multicultural means that mixed faith marriages are going to become more numerous, will force the religious institutions to cope and accept mixed faith households. Whether we approve or not is another matter, but certainly from a Jewish community, the Jewish person is still Jewish and the non-Jewish person should be treated with every respect and courtesy.
Well, that's all for this week. My thanks to Jonathan Romain, Rosalind Birtwistle and Asad Zaman. I'll be back again at the same time next week. Do join me.